Support for Iditapod, a production of Alaska Public Media, comes from MVFCU. Experience the MVFCU way.
One, two, three, four.
Welcome to the Iditapod, a podcast about, of course, about the Iditarod. We are a production of Alaska Public Media and KNOM in Nome. I'm your host, Casey Grove. Before we really get into this, here's a word from our sponsor.
Support for Iditapod 2018 comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaska's communities.
The clock in the 2018 Iditarod just keeps on ticking. We're approaching one full week of racing. The leaders are something like 600 miles into the 1,000-mile race to Nome and that famed burled arch that is the finish line. I have a feeling, it's only an inkling for now, call it prognostication, that we're going to see a close finish there on Front Street. Again, just a guess, we could see the front runners coming into Nome on Tuesday. Side note, it's daylight savings time tonight, and that means we're going to spring forward an hour. That does not affect the race clock, but it does sometimes throw some confusion into the race, maybe causes some of us to lose a little bit more sleep than we would otherwise. But for now, it's Saturday. At least it is as I'm recording this, and not only will it take the leaders a couple more days, but it'll be a few more days after that that we see the rest of the Iditarod mushers crossing the finish line. With the leaders on the mighty Yukon River, through the village checkpoint of Grayling and into Eagle Island, which, as we'll hear coming up, has been downgraded from checkpoint to mere hospitality stop, the rest of the field stretches back another 200-ish miles. At the front, we still have Girdwood's Nicholas Petit, Mitch Seavey, the defending champ out of Seward, and your Leifseth Olsom from Norway. Petit and Olsom are, of course, each vying for their first Iditarod win, while Seavey is going for his fourth. That chase pack is really shaping up, too, with Ray Reddington Jr., Pete Kaiser, and Richie Deal making up some ground on the leaders. All three of those are among the Alaska Native mushers in the race, as well as Ray's brothers Ryan and Robert and a few others. We had a story from KNOM's Davis Hovey about Native mushers in yesterday's podcast, so maybe give that a listen if you haven't already. Pretty cool to see these guys helping keep alive a mushing tradition that goes back literally hundreds of years through generations of their families. And cool to see Ray, Pete, and Richie mushing close together up towards the front and doing so well. They're still right there in it, and like I said, it's hard to predict how this could go still, especially when the race hits the Bering Sea coast. For these mushers traveling out there in the wilderness, it's also tough to know what the weather's going to do. It's always a possibility that a big storm will brew up and it'll come in there and change things around. As always, weather has been a big factor in this year's race. There have been reports of planes in the Iditarod Air Force. That's what we call all the bush planes that shuttle supplies, officials, volunteers, and even journalists all the way down the trail into checkpoints and on to Nome. Those planes getting weathered in at the checkpoint of Iditarod, and that's caused some big changes farther down the trail. And I just want to point out, as the Iditarod.com folks did, the sled dog teams are still making it through this. The planes get grounded because it's sometimes too unsafe to fly in bad weather, but the dog teams, they're still a very reliable means of transportation out there. And, you know, it wouldn't be an Iditarod without a little weather. This year, that's caused a critical checkpoint to all but shut down, forcing top teams to adapt their run-rest strategies amid the long, flat slog up the Yukon River. As Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports, with planes unable to get supplies out to Eagle Island, the mushers are scrambling to get a mandatory rest in before one of the most formidable overnight trips of the race.
Oh, true love. It's so hard to find.
The mood inside the Anvik City building is festive. Two people are playing guitar by the door. Crews of snow machiners who have been following the race at a leisurely pace are stretched out at folding tables, trading stories over black cups of coffee. And a few teenagers pop in and out to scan the room, looking for visitors who might be willing to pay $5 or $10 for a snow machine ride to avoid hoofing it up the town's big, steep hill. Just outside, the mood could not be more different.
Yep, I heard.
There's only one bale of straw for you at Grayling if you
want. That sucks.
Jessie Royer is polite but direct as she hears about checkpoint changes resulting from the Eagle Island situation. The austere stop is midway through a long run between the communities of Grayling and Caltag. And since the Iditarod pilots couldn't bring in food or supplies, on Friday morning, officials made the decision to downgrade it from a checkpoint to just a hospitality spot, a little more than a shelter cabin with some supplies for heating up water. That means Royer and other mushers have to load up on supplies, like food and straw, at Grayling, then haul whatever they need for 130 miles. Conveying those complicated logistical adjustments to tired, rushing mushers fell on volunteer checker N.J. Gates.
You can take what you want from here.
Yeah, you know, it just kind of sucks to really get one bale there.
There is heat at Eagle Island, but no straw.
For the top 20 or so mushers, the race is still very much up in the air, with some of the sport's best all clustered tightly together, separated by mere minutes. Teams arriving into Anvik are suddenly facing not just the usual battery of questions from vets and checkers, but also a barrage of information about reshuffled logistics with their supply bags. As Richie Deal pulls up just minutes after one musher and a few before the next, he's trying to process new information and incorporate it into plans 3, 4, and 5 steps down the line.
They did not get our bags.
Richie Deal, you've got two in Grayling.
Are those the ones from Eagle Island?
Yes.
Okay, they're there?
Yes.
Okay, so I should have 4 total then.
Well, you've got 2 confirmed at Grayling.
Well, those are my Grayling bags though.
No.
Deal and the others are making those kinds of calculations on the fly, sleep deprived and facing a night of descending temperatures and worsening headwinds. Earlier in the day, the Eagle Island change seemed to make everyone reassess where they'd stop for their 8-hour rest that has to be taken at one of the checkpoints along the Yukon River. Many mushers opted to do it at the first possible stop, in Shagaluk. On arriving in Anvik, Wade Mars tells the small crowd that wasn't his original plan.
Sorry we missed you guys this year. I was hoping to come here.
Yeah, next time.
The weather,
you never know, hey?
Did not permit.
Good luck.
Thank you guys very much.
All right.
This isn't the first time in the race's history that Eagle Island has had to essentially close down because of weather. And race judge Kevin Psyche says coping with the unexpected is a fundamental element to the competition.
You know, one of the whole factors about this Iditarod experience is the flexibility that people need to have to adapt to changing weather, trail conditions, whatever the case might be, you know.
One person the change did not quite so negatively impact is Nick Petit. He reached Anvik early Friday morning and declared his 8-hour rest, way before a decision about Eagle Island was ever made. Still, like everyone else, it means he'll have to haul more supplies in his sled, getting from Grayling to Kaltag.
Well, it changes everybody's plan, doesn't it? Even if you don't have a plan, it changes things. No big deal, but I gotta go, guys.
And with that, Petit rouses his dogs and sets off for the long run ahead. On the Iditarod Trail in Anvik, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
There's also been a little speculation that because Eagle Island is now just a hospitality stop, and like Zach said, mushers are having to load up on supplies to last about 130 miles, their sleds will be heavier, run times will be longer, and that all might equal things out a bit among who would have been the fastest mushers. Zach's story there also had a checker mentioning heat pretty much being the only thing available at Eagle Island. That's not heat, H-E-A-T, it's H-E-E-T. That's the name of a product manufactured for putting in your car's gas tank to displace or remove water that gets in there. It's also what the mushers use as a kind of camp fuel. I think it's basically alcohol, and it burns nice and clean. It's very popular among mushers, and you'll see boxes and boxes of this stuff at checkpoints. They all carry some type of cooker for heating up water, and they'll gouge open these plastic yellow bottles of heat, dump some in the bottom of their cooker, and in a separate sort of pot above that, they'll heat up water to mix with dog food and their own food. A lot of times they'll have their trail food in like vacuum-packed plastic bags, and they'll dunk those in the pot while the water heats up. And that heats up their food while they're dishing out the food for the dogs that's mixed with water, helps hydrate the dogs. That's how they get water into their bodies, really. Those meals are nothing compared to what's available in Takatna. Mushers are well past that checkpoint, and we've talked a lot about the great food in Takatna. It's a popular spot to take a 24-hour layover, but it bears repeating. Takatna is legendary for its pies. And it's a big deal that the village attracts so much attention and so many visitors during the Iditarod. Some of the communities along the Iditarod Trail have been abandoned over the many years, and some remain intact, like Takatna. We have this report from KNOM's Davis Hovey on some of the reasons, including pie, that Takotna has endured all these years.
Takotna first became a checkpoint along the Iditarod Trail in 1981, and for almost the last 20 straight years, the race route has gone through the community. Nell Huffman has been running the show for Iditarod and Takotna ever since Jan Newton, the famous pie maker, passed away.
She was very good at teaching all of us and all of our children how to bake pies. We have an oven problem this year here, so pies are being baked in numerous houses around town.
Even though the pies have continued, according to 65-year-old Huffman, some things have changed over the years. The race has gotten faster, and she's noticed more tourists coming into town. But for the most part, the sleepy little town of 50 people has remained consistent.
We really have tried to keep it basically the same, basically simple here. We're really geared for the mushers, and we try to be, everything is musher first. And we feed all the rest, and we do ask for donations from everyone that is not Iditarod. So that's how we sustain it. And we support it with a selling pop.
Huffman is referring to Soda Pop, of course, although currently their one vending machine is not working. Normally, the community sells cans of soda for $2.25 each, which Huffman says brings in tremendous revenue. And like most checkpoints along the trail, the Iditarod makes a big impact on Takotna when it comes through and even when it doesn't.
Well, we miss it because it's our biggest week of the whole year. A lot of planning. It's school lessons go into learning about the Iditarod. Most of our kids can name all the mushers. They greet the mushers. And they still do that, but it doesn't imprint like it does when the race is here.
Huffman's daughter, Tabitha Meglich, has seen about 20 Iditarods. That exposure is what got her into handling dogs and dog sled mushing.
My teacher in elementary school, like first, second grade, he had the kids start being pooper scoopers and helping with the drop dogs. And first and second grade, that's what I was doing. But I had a dog team and I knew how to be around dogs. So at 14, they put me in charge of parking the dogs.
Meglich says her main job is handling dogs, but her other duties include running the local store, teaching children, and baking pies, which is the task at hand as we are speaking. With limited sources of income for those who choose to settle in Takotna, according to Meglich, quite a few families in the community live off of $10,000 to $15,000 a year. She says the short-term job opportunities that sometimes open up are just enough to sustain the community.
During the summer, pretty much everyone can have a full-time job because the mines all open up. Then we have to haul fuel. This summer we're going to have rehab the library. So that'll be probably 5 or 6 full-time jobs for locals for about 3 months. And it might be the only work some of them have all year.
She notes that it's relatively cheap to live in Takotna thanks to subsidies from the state. And as long as the community is sustained, Meglich hopes the Iditarod race will continue to endure as well so that her kids and their friends can enjoy the race like she does.
A lot of these kids, their families cannot afford to have them go into town at all. So this is like one of the only opportunities they get to see a bunch of strangers and see different ethnicities and beliefs and accents. It's good exposure for them.
Most of the 64 mushers competing in this year's race, along with the fanfare it brings, have already come and gone through Takotna, leaving the usual population of 50-plus people to their normal, quiet lives. For KNOM News on the Iditarod Trail in Takotna, I'm Davis Hovey.
Maybe I'm just food-obsessed, but I feel like we can't talk enough about pie. Takotna's pies in the past included raspberry, blueberry, peach, pumpkin, raspberry cherry, and other varieties. And it's really cool to hear that they're still, even with some oven trouble, coming together in Takotna to make sure that there's a lot of food, and in particular pie for mushers and others coming through there. You heard Davis mention 64 mushers in the race. We started with 67. Doing a little simple math, that means there have been 3 scratches so far. Just to recap, that was Zoya Denier, Didi Johnro, and yesterday we got word that Washingtonian musher Scott White pulled out of the race. So 64 still out there, leapfrogging, passing each other at times. They're also starting to pass by competitors in the Iditarod Trail Invitational. That is also a 1,000-mile race, but it's done on bike, skis, or on foot even. Humans out there pulling sleds with their supplies, and it's crazy. There are also slightly less insane, but still crazy, 300 and 130-mile versions. That brings us to today's listener question. It's from one of our radio colleagues, one of the best voices in Alaska Public Radio.
Hi, I did a pod. This is Anna Rose from Bethel, Alaska. What is the relationship and interaction like between the competitors in the Iditarod Trail Invitational and the Iditarod Mushers? Thanks. Love the pod.
Hello, Anna Rose in Bethel. Fancy you being curious about the Iditarod Trail Invitational. The ITI is one of the parallel events that sprung up beside the Iditarod. It's like an ultra marathon along the whole length of the Iditarod Trail. People do it on foot, on skis, and on fat tire bikes, and it happens at roughly the same time as the Iditarod. Actually, haven't gotten to ask any mushers about their thoughts on these folks, but I can tell you that when they appear at checkpoints or in villages, people just think they are crazy. And funnily enough, at breakfast in Anvik, I just so happened to be sitting across from a guy who knows a lot about the ITI.
Kyle Durand, D-U-R-A-N-D, and I am riding my bike 1,000 miles across the Iditarod Trails, part of the Iditarod Trail Invitational, a race that I'm the race director of.
Durand's not actually racing, he's just biking the full length of the trail. And actually, because these guys start a little while before the mushers, they've only recently started seeing them along the trail. And I asked if there are any rules or etiquette about trail passing.
Yes, get out of the way. Generally, we tell all of our competitors, you know, keep your head in a swivel. Don't, you know, wear earbuds because there's traffic on the trail and we need to get out of the way for it. So generally, if we hear a snow machine coming up, we'll step off into the deep snow, sometimes, you know, up to waist deep to let them go by. The tough one is trying to stay away from the dog teams because you don't hear them coming.
And what are you eating right now?
Oatmeal. A lot, and muffins and deviled eggs and everything in sight.
Whatever you can get.
I call it the locust diet. It's just eat everything.
Basically, the rule of thumb for everyone out on the trail while the Iditarod sled dog race is happening is to defer to the mushers. Whether you're on a bike, snow machine, skis, or just a reporter trying to get the perfect camera shot, when a dog team is going by, you need to get the heck out of the way. Thank you, Anna Rose.
That's Zach with some help answering a question from KYUK News Director Anna Rose MacArthur. As always, please send us your questions. We love hearing from the listeners. You can send those to iditarod@alaskapublic.org. The best way to do it is to send a voice memo. Anna Rose might have had some recording equipment, but you probably also have some recording equipment in your pocket. If you have a smartphone, you can just open up the voice memo app, record your question, send that on in, like I said, to iditarod@alaskapublic.org. It's great for us to have audio of those questions because we like to mix it up here. We work in audio. So a big part of Zach's challenge as a trail reporter is filing stories, audio, photos, even answers to these questions. It involves getting access to internet out in rural Alaska, which isn't always easy, but this is so much easier than it was back in the day. And we have this piece from another KYUK colleague. It's Johanna Urich, and she's talking about what it used to be like to cover the Iditarod.
I spend my days on the computer looking at a map created by the Electronic Global Positioning System instruments carried by sled dog teams on the trail during the Iditarod race. With a few clicks, I can see who is where and whether they're racing or resting. Another click gives me access to the official list of current race standings. There, I can even watch tiny clips of video interviews done with some of the mushers. In my cabin in Anchorage, I work this information into little updates, concentrating on the three local mushers from the delta of the Yukon and Kuskokwim rivers in this year's race, and email it to KYUK, the radio station in Bethel, which is physically much closer than I am to the mushers on the trail as they come out of the Alaska Range and head to the Yukon River. You can hear my words minutes later in the local news. This type of interconnectivity is the norm for the younger generation. But I remember covering the race before all of this was available. It was 1997, the year of the Hale-Bopp comet, and the Alaska Public Radio Network had decided not to invest its resources in organizing statewide coverage of the race. I was working for one of the state's tiniest public radio stations, KTNA in Talkeetna, a community which was, and in many ways remains, a center for mushing in the valley of the Matanuska and Susitna rivers. We decided to organize the coverage ourselves and rely on our listeners to help us. Some of them were volunteer pilots for the Iditarod Trail Committee. Another young reporter at KCHU in Valdez, Dan Bross, an avid athlete and deeply interested in the sport of mushing, decided to help. We pooled our resources and shared a plane with a reporter from the Fairbanks Daily News Miner. That way, we could use two planes and be able to be in the front and back of the pack at the same time, getting different angles on the 1,000-mile race to Nome. Covering the race in those days meant you had to send stories back on the phone or persuade a pilot. Flying a small plane carrying drop dogs back to caretakers in Anchorage to take a cassette tape with them and then call the network to tell them when to send someone to the landing strip or airport, often a frozen lake, to pick it up. It also meant sending scripts and instructions for mixing and editing the final piece from the cassette you provided. To produce that cassette, I brought two small machines, clip leads, and a cable to both record and dub off the sections of tape for my story. The final product was a cassette tape with an announce track, followed by rough, unedited sound, followed by another voice track, etc. The engineers had to dub it all onto reel-to-reel magnetic tape, adjusting the level and then splicing it together using a razor blade, a splicing block. That's a carefully tooled piece of metal, so your razor blade would always cut the tape in the exact same angle. Then they had to stick the good bits together with splicing tape. Brian O'Donohue, the Fairbanks reporter sharing the plane with me, was trying a whole new system. He would use his computer to send his print stories and some audio on something called the Internet. I remember watching him trying to upload, we didn't even use that word then, a small audio clip. It would take him more than half an hour, and it still would not go through properly. He was stubborn and determined and would try over and over again, working late. Some nights he did not get much sleep. I kept using the phone and planes when available. Anytime we arrived at a village checkpoint, we would head to where officials were checking in the teams and ask for a copy of the recent standings. They were hesitant to give them to us because it was a pain to make copies or print it out. But I came prepared. I had a box of homemade chocolate truffles made by a chef in Talkeetna. Food in these remote communities was not the best. I would take out this lovely dark ball of wonderfulness and offer it to the Iditarod volunteer gatekeeper, and he would drool and enjoy every bite, and slide across the piece of paper with the information I needed. I often thanked him with an additional truffle. By the way, that year Martin Boozer won the race by over 12 hours. He was so far ahead of the other front runners that mushers joked that the Hale-Bopp comet was Martin's headlamp leading them all into Nome. For KYUK, I'm Johanna Urich.
Wow, I just love hearing dog mushing stories and definitely bush Alaska journalism stories. It's just amazing how things have changed. Well, that's all we have time for today. It's Sunday tomorrow, but we'll be back with another installment of the Iditapod. You can find us, as always, on iTunes or other podcatcher apps. Subscribe to us there if you aren't already. Or you can listen online at alaskapublic.org. We have the rest of our Iditarod coverage there as well. Our theme music here for the podcast is by the band Sassafras. I'm Casey Grove, and until next time, happy trails.
Hi, Hi, it's Matthew.
Hey, Matt. It's Casey Grove at Alaska Public Media. How's it going?
Casey, how are you?
What's going on, man? Why are you tweeting about my bunny boots?
I believe it's a lack thereof, Casey. I noticed a past tense for bunny boots, and I'm certainly my podcast speaker must have been mispronouncing words or something, because there's no self-respecting Alaskan covering the Iditarod who doesn't currently own bunny boots. Or are you a total fraud?
You know, I'm going to try to restrain myself. This is a family podcast, and you know, I can't use the words that I really want to use with you right now, but I need to tell you that I still own those bunny boots. All right. And you don't even live here anymore, man. So like, why are you telling me I don't have like Alaska credibility?
Because making fun of people's lack of Alaska credibility is the only shred of Alaska credibility I have left. Sorry.